Martha's really done a great job of organizing this, and even though she says it wasn't, I know it is a lot of work, so I'm very grateful to her for that, and I'm really delighted to be here. I'm going to spend time this morning telling you about a unit that I developed around the Silk Road, hence the title of my talk, and what you're seeing here is an image of some of my students actively engaged, I think, in one of the activities that I developed around the Silk Road. And I'm a Mac user, so I have my fingers crossed using a PC. Okay. What I'd like to do is begin with the question of how do we learn, and then I'll turn to a little bit of a discussion on interdisciplinary teaching and learning, and I'll focus on, in particular, the Silk Road unit. So to begin, what do we know about learning? If you weren't here this morning when Martha gave us this excellent opening presentation, she talked and made reference to what scholars know about how we learn. She mentioned, I think in passing anyway, Bloom's taxonomy, and I'm here to admit that I was teaching well past a decade before I'd ever heard of this, and I thought, is it like some cladistic analysis? Because I haven't had taxonomy and systematics in a long time. No, and if you haven't heard about it and you hang around with people that know what they're doing when they teach, we actually have training in it, unlike myself, you find out that when often this is this Bloom's taxonomy is presented as is shown here as a triangle at the apex of which is the word evaluation. And the idea here is that students, humans in general, and students in particular for our purposes, learn by going through a series of steps. Typically. And so, for instance, at the very base of this triangle, we have knowledge, that is the acquisition of information. It doesn't necessarily mean you understand it. And if you were here this morning for Martha's opening talk, you know that we can have information, and if we don't have the context, we don't understand it. And so they move through, we as humans and students as humans, at times they're human, pass through these predictable stages that pretty much come into play, and that is they have to be able to comprehend the material, and then in the next level of learning, on the approach to deep learning, they learn how to apply that knowledge that they've acquired in a new setting, a new framework. If they're even more sophisticated in their learning, they understand the components of that. They can use analytic thinking with that new knowledge. And then they can synthesize. We always talk about telling our students we want them to synthesize. I bet, at least I know I didn't usually explain what I meant by that. And then finally, evaluation. They should be able to bring informed information that has some reasoned expertise along with it to evaluate new knowledge related to this acquired knowledge. So that's what scholars tell us about learning. So that was Bloom's taxonomy. This came out in the 50s. Since then, and Martha's introduced us to this, the generative learning model has been put forth. And if you've not picked up a handout, there might be one in the back. And in fact, there is a handout for me as well. I'm going to ask you to do a little activity with me later, and so Martha's looks like she's going to be my TA. Basically, the generative learning model, and Martha kindly applied this alongside of Bloom's taxonomy in her handout for us. You can kind of see similar things going on here, but this is a more recent model, and it deals with a couple of different issues. The first of which, if we start at the bottom here, I'm going to tentatively touch that. Perfect. Number one, we see that we have to focus our attention. I hope I just focused our attention, and I'm going to try to do so again on number one. You focus the student's attention, and then they can acquire new information, and then they move up through these levels. They have to recall number two and comprehend the new information. We try to have them relate it to this new information, to previous information, so as the theme of the meeting is, they can make connections, and then they can finally, in step four, start constructing real meaning. When they get to step five in this model, it might be that what they've learned and what they know previously doesn't always agree. There are so-called gray areas, and in that instance, they may have to deal with some resolution. How do I deal with things that don't quite fit? Again, if you were here for the first session, you saw examples of that, and you saw that with Dr. Juergen's talk, where different examples that you may be giving students or prompting them with don't fit the model they're used to working with. Ultimately, the goal is we want them to have it in their long-term memory. Now, I've belabored that a little bit, but I'm going to come back to it at the end of my talk. You see implicit in both of these models, importantly, that you are requiring, or the models require, the students to take on greater responsibility. That is, they're not going to sit back like I'm doing to you right now. I'm putting you to sleep. I'm telling you everything. I'm asking you to do nothing but maybe keep your eyes open. So the responsibility is all on me. You're passive. We're going to change that in a little bit. So I want you to keep in mind that yellow arrow, and I want you to keep in mind the six steps of the generative learning model, because at the end, I'm going to use Martha's handout and my handout, I hope, where I'm going to ask you to recall the kind of teaching strategies I used that relate to the six steps of the generative learning model, and see if you can help me figure out how well I did in trying to get my students to number six, which is linking this information to other areas, going through the first five steps, that is, and seeing if it might be in their long-term memory. And we don't have them here, so we don't have my students here. You know, they could be doing who knows what, and whether it's in their long-term memory anymore, I'm not sure either. But that's what our exercise will be at the end of the talk. So we're making connections to learning theory, and we're going to do it with the six activities I'm going to tell you about that I do around this Silk Road unit. Okay, so the course that this unit is a part of is called Insects, Science, and World Cultures. This is part of our general education program, and as such, I get kids from all kinds of majors. Dr. Juergen talked about this earlier. I can have music majors. I can have biology. Kids that maybe are interested in biology and know something about it. So there's a big range. And not that all music majors don't know biology. I don't mean to imply that by any measure. When I first thought about the course, I decided that the structure would be two 50-minute content discussion periods. I could do these as I wished. I could do as I'm doing now, hopefully giving you content before I put you to sleep, but then I could engage the students in discussion, and my lectures could be interactive, even if they were lectures for 50 minutes. And then I would have, at the end of the week, a 3-hour lab session that was tied to that given unit. When I first thought about the course, I only knew that I wanted to emphasize a global interdisciplinary view. And if you ask me questions later, I could tell you about why that is and how I came to think about that one night when I couldn't sleep. The one thing I didn't want to provide was a survey course, because our department already did that. So we don't talk about the orders of insects in this course. I thought heavily about the pedagogy. By then I had started realizing there was actually a theory of learning, and I might try to use that. And so I had decided, if you'll recall that yellow arrow, I wanted my students to start taking more responsibility for their learning. So again, by way of making connections to learning theory. So the pedagogy, I decided right off when I designed the course, was going to be inquiry-based. It was going to be very active learning. I was not going to tell them a lot. They were going to be frustrated, because I wasn't going to say, do it this way. Although I would tell them what I wanted, in the end, I wouldn't tell them necessarily exactly how to get there. It was going to be very hands-on, and I knew at the outset that I was sacrificing breadth at the expense of depth. I wanted to go in depth so that I could hopefully get them to get some deeper learning, and I was very interested in process much more than content. Okay? So with that in mind, I want to just share with you something I found very useful that, as a teacher, again, ashamedly for many years, I had no idea about learning, teaching and learning, and theories that surround them. One of the things I came upon, because I hung out with some people that knew what they were doing in the teaching arena, was something called a teaching goals inventory. And if you Google this term, you'll come up with that website, so you don't need to write it down. It comes from the University of Iowa, where Martha got her degree in science education. And you can, for free, take a teaching goals inventory online. Now, this was developed by Tom Angelo and Patricia Cross, and these are two people that are widely regarded in the field of teaching and learning, particularly student assessment of learning, or assessment of student learning, excuse me. So you go online, and there'll be a little bit of a preamble that will tell you what this goals inventory does. And then they have 52 short bulleted goals that allow you to think about the specific course or even a unit that you have in mind, and it forces you to articulate what are you after. So I had these nebulous ideas. I just told you, I knew I wanted to be global. I knew I wanted to be interdisciplinary. I didn't know anything more than that, and I was interested in process of learning. So I went through these 52 bulleted prompts, and it provided me, and here's some examples here. Was I really interested in this course improving students' reading skills? No, I figured they knew how to read. Was I interested in them doing some problem solving? Yes. Was I interested in their ability to draw reasonable inferences from observations? Yes. There's a Likert scale from 0 to 5 that you rate this on, and then you get your results. And here are some results as an example. And here's what happens when you use a Mac at the ESA meeting and you forget that you had one slide in there. You forgot in the upper left corner. So this is a learning moment for Carol. But the name of the book is there, Classroom Assessment Techniques, and I'll come back to that in a minute. These are the results from a learning goals inventory that I took for the purposes of today's talk. And you'll see on the left-hand column, it's labeled cluster in blue, and then it has higher order thinking skills highlighted in yellow. That was because when I got done with my goals inventory, it told me that 75% of my responses to those 52 prompts, I was very interested in my students gaining higher order thinking skills. By contrast, I was assuming they had basic academic success skills, okay? The other thing I was obviously interested in when I answered this was liberal arts and academic values. Now, why do you care about this? As I said, it forces you to articulate what you're really after. You may have nebulous views, but the other thing is you can link it to this book that you can't see that's called Classroom Assessment Techniques, and this is by Cross and Angelo, and in there are scores of examples of what you can do in class with your students to target these clusters of these learning areas that are not multiple choice exams and they're not term papers. Okay, so they're really wonderful activities, and from all different disciplines. Okay, so I did all that, and then I said, all right, I've got the course. What am I doing? What's my learning goal? I decided my goal was as stated here. I wanted to look at the impact of insects on human affairs with these non-majors kids in a general ed course. I wanted activities that were going to foster interdisciplinary, global, historical, and current perspectives. Okay, I tell them this on the syllabus, it's part of the syllabus, and I also tell them I am targeting these skills. I've noticed their information literacy isn't great, but it isn't, because they see it on the internet, it must be true. I'm interested in them knowing what a primary and secondary source is, how do they evaluate their sources. I tell them there is going to be a lot of communication, as Laurel said earlier. Sometimes when she gives out the syllabus, people leave. When I tell them there are no exams, but they're going to be doing a lot of work in the class, and a lot of it is going to be talking, oral, and written, I lose some students, admittedly. And I'm also interested in them at times. They have to go through the semester and rear insects and observe and gather data, present findings. So they know up front that the activities I've designed are targeting these skills. Hopefully, then, they don't think it's just busy work. Again, very interested in interdisciplinary and global approaches, perspectives in fostering that in the students. Okay, so what I'm really doing, if I haven't made it clear, I'm really kind of using insects as a vehicle here. I'm not so much concerned that they come out and know that insects, forgive me, have 6 legs, okay? I'm really using it as a vehicle for general education. So what kinds of things do we do in the class? Well, we do a big unit on nutrition. We heard Laurel mention that earlier. I think it's a 12-page worksheet they have to do on insect nutrition. And then as a way to think about human nutrition, we look at the USDA guidelines. They have to write out what do they eat when they're at school, what do they eat on the weekends when they might be eating differently, and what do they eat when they're with their families, which is very different. Shockingly, I know, my son's doing the same thing now, than with, you know, when they're home versus when they're on their own. And then I link all of this to world cuisines because I'm trying to get at not isn't it cool that other people eat insects, but why might that be? Is protein at a premium? Can we look at the demographics of certain countries? And so then there's geography interspersed in there, okay? So that's one of the things we do. Another thing I'm very big on is having students understand why we study fruit flies and what do we glean from this? Why does the NIH put a lot of money into working on nematodes and bacteria? And so I talk a lot about models in insects as models in research and medicine. And then I do some arts and humanities things. And what you're seeing here is a bowl. This is from the Membris culture. This was a group of people that were very active in southwestern United States around, I think, 800 AD. They had a lot of insect motifs on their pottery, and so you're seeing a piece here of flying insects. Okay, so that's kind of the themes I go through in the course, and I'm going to turn now to this unit on insect products. So, we're at the Silk Road. If you're interested, yeah, thank you. I was thinking, my God, I only have 5 minutes left? What a lousy teacher. I thought I prepared this course, this class. Okay, so the Silk Road unit, if you want to do interdisciplinary teaching, this is a beautiful topic to take up with your students. What we do is it takes a couple weeks. I'll tell you about this in detail now. We use three insect products. There are silk scarves and cochineal to dye the scarves and beeswax to do batiking. And if any of you are really interested, that's my email up here at the end, and you can ask me how we do this exactly. Okay, so three insect products takes place over the course of 2 weeks. I give them three lectures that I try to make very interactive with prompts embedded in the lectures, and this is by means of giving them background info. They also have a web activity that I'm going to tell you about, and two laboratories. Now, these are six different activities, and remember, I'm going to be asking you to try to see how I made the connection with my teaching strategies to the generative learning models. This is where you're going to be wanting taking notes, because it'll be on the test at the end of my lecture. Okay, so first thing you do is give them an introduction to the Silk Road by means of a lecture. As you know, this was a very vibrant trade route from about the second century before the current era through the 14th century. It's interdisciplinary in many ways because goods, ideas, inventions, different aspects of religions and culture went both ways as the trade and travel took place between China and Europe and North Africa. So we talk a little bit about that, but not much because they have to find out the information, as you'll see in a minute. I tell them about sumptuary laws about which I knew nothing. I didn't even know the word. But fortunately, I have friends that have expertise in medieval literature and fabric. And so they could tell me what these were, which are these laws that forbade people to wear certain things like silk and certain colors of silk unless you were a certain social class. And then we turn to the silk industry in the U.S., again, about which I knew almost zero, except that it was attempted by means of trying to import the gypsy moth. But actually, prior to that, it was about trying to rear. It was really sericulture, and they brought in, apparently, the wrong mulberry trees for these, for Bombyx mori. So there's a very rich history there. And then, of course, I'm sure you're probably aware of the fabric mills that went on, and you can tie all that into labor unions and such. Okay, so I give them a brief introduction. The end of the lecture, and here's a slide from the lecture, I tell them they're going to take a tour of the Silk Road, and that Wednesday when they come to class, 2 days later, there's going to be the Web of Knowledge Day, and they have to share their information. Okay, so they're all given a handout of homework, and believe it or not, Martha, it's actually called, and before I knew we were doing this, Can You Make the Silk Road Connections? So everybody has to do part one of this. They have background questions just to get them all on the same page. I give them a couple of websites. There are excellent scholarly websites there. And they're kind of answering questions. What is the Silk Road? Why is it a misnomer? Well, because there were lots of silk roads and routes. And so they come into class prepared. And the reason is they have an individualized sheet they have to do. There are terms that only certain people have to answer. Each person has his or her own set of terms. And I tell them that when they come in, they're preparing to be sleuths, and that I've highlighted information on their particular handout that they have to find out from the websites. And they come in prepared to share. And when you do this, amazingly, students don't want to be embarrassed. They come in prepared. So, if you were this student, part two of your handout would show that you have five terms that you have to be responsible for, and I have them divided like Jeopardy into three columns here: people and places, technology and products, or ideas and other. They can come in with their notes. In fact, they have to turn them in for graded credit. Okay, and then they come in, And I have a ball of twine, and I start them off. Somebody volunteers, or I give it to a student. And that student selects a term that they've been given and tells about it. And then somebody else says, I can make a connection to that. And the person, first person, holds the end of the twine, tosses the ball, and the next person debriefs the class on how they can make the connection. And so on among all the students. And in this way, all the terms are debriefed in the 50-minute period. Everybody gets to talk. They actually are prepared. I don't know if it goes into their long-term memory. It's a great icebreaker. So that's the first thing we do with the the second thing now. We've linked this activity to the lecture. Okay, now comes the fun, the batiking and mordants. And I'm waiting for this to come up, but let's see. There should be a yellow bar. And it didn't come up. Let me tell you what it said. It said, I have to go over lab safety with them because they're dealing with hot water and burners. All right, and cochineal, which can cause irritation to the hands, so they use gloves. Some of the equipment, then, we give them a little introduction to materials and methods and lab safety. The equipment they're using is shown here, and these are Jant tools. I can tell you how to get these if you're interested. And they're going to do batiking. Here's beeswax that's going to be melted in potpourri pots. Much of this comes from the Goodwill, except for the Jant tools. Here's a student actually using the Jant tools. It allows you to apply the wax in a neat way. They're like a little pipe with a spigot on the bottom. And so here's a student batiking. And then we use mordants. Mordants are chemicals. You see four of them listed here that we've experimented with in the lab that allows you to change the fabric of the silk in a way that permanently alters it so that when you come in with the cochineal dye, you end up getting different colors and different hues, and I'll show you what those look like here. These are swatches where students either have experimented with them to see different concentrations, so there's some empirical work involved on their part, weighing out the mordants, weighing out the cochineal in the next lab, and experimenting with concentrations and dye times and times in the mordant. And you can see go Cougs, because you know that's who we are. Okay, so that's the first lab. They've gotten the scarves ready to receive the cochineal. Then they come into class the next week, and I give them a lecture again, try to be interactive, unlike what I'm doing with you so far. And we talk about sericulture and silkworms. I tell them amazing facts, like caterpillars are not worms, and silk is caterpillar spit. And I know you guys, I think you've all passed oral exams, and you all know this stuff. But they're actually rather amazed. And we talk about things that they usually don't know about, and that is that silk has really unique mechanical properties. This is, again, one of these lectures where I have to go back and learn stuff that I don't know, such as what are these unusual mechanical properties. It has to do with tensile strength and the fact that silk is very lightweight yet very sturdy. It's also used in biomedical repair, and the military, like the DOD, is real interested in silk because of these mechanical properties. Sericulture. I tell them about Bombyx mori, and this is in red, this rearing, because if anybody knows an artificial diet that works, I don't have access to mulberry leaves. I'm embarrassed to say my PhD was partly on insect rearing and artificial diets, incorporating leaf material, and I couldn't get the artificial diets to work. So if anybody knows of a good one, let me know, even one that I can make up in the lab. Doesn't have to be commercially available. So that didn't work. I wanted them to rear silkworms. And then we talk about current world silk production. Okay, and then there's one more lecture. This is on cochineal, telling them a little bit about the taxonomy, only so they understand what taxonomy is and why it's meaningful, as Ken Jurgen told us, and their natural history of this insect. And this is another beautiful thing if you want to do interdisciplinary teaching. The historical significance of the cochineal is very, very rich. It starts off with pre-Columbian times in Central and South America, and then you can go into the colonial era. Cochineal was a very important player on a world scale in economics, and there are unbelievable monographs written on this from historians and books. There's a recent book written on it. Until Allen and Dyes came in and kind of cochineal then took a hit in the world economy. But nonetheless, Peru is still heavily involved in producing cochineal, and so we talk a little bit about that. And then I send them to the grocery store, not to see if the oranges are with toilet paper, and those of you who are for Hereford. Ken Juergens talk know what I'm talking about. But rather to have them try to find where cochineal is used currently. I give them a few hints, and then when they come back the following class period, they debrief and they tell me all the different products where they found cochineal, which by the way is also known as carmine. Perfect, 5 minutes. Okay. And here you see some of the results of their work. Up in the first panel there, you have students grinding the cochineal insects. Again, reminding you that if you do this, you should have some gloves for the students in case they have an allergy. You see students boiling the scarves in the dye bath, and then the results of their products. And you notice that Joe and Amanda down in the right-hand corner, by the way, Amanda's a voice major, very successful and about to graduate. You can see the different colors and hues that were achieved by using these different mordants and the dye baths. So now, here we are. I hope you were all paying attention. I gave you 25 minutes of nothing but passive, you know, activity. You're asleep, you're tired, you're probably hungry. So what a great place to be in for me as the teacher. What I'm going to ask you to do now is think about the generative learning model. You guys can come in. You can sit down if you'd like, or not if you don't want to. I'm pretty easy with my students. Think about the generative learning model. I have them the numbers 1 through 6 that come from that handout of Martha and also of me, where I stole it from Martha's handout, and see how well we did. And I'm going to remind you now, we're going to make connections between learning theory and teaching strategies in particular to achieve these goals, and think about the Silk Road activities that we talked about, where we looked at the lecture that I gave them on the Silk Road, the Web of Knowledge, etc. And my email will come up here in a minute if you need to contact me. I can give you protocols for doing these other things I talked about, and I'd be happy to do so. So, questions, or can you make these connections? And I started you off on my handout, I think, but I don't remember what I put down. Okay, so I had, what did I have? Class. Bueller, what? The lecture on cochineal. Thank you. So what did I do? I left it open as to what I was doing on the teaching strategy. What do you think I did? So I gave them a lecture on cochineal. I had them go to the grocery store. What was I doing there? I was hoping for candy. I was hoping they would find it in candy and bring it in and we could eat it. But other than that, connecting new information. Yeah, they didn't know. Your students will be amazed when you tell them that they're eating insects in the form of dye in Mike and Ike, I think, and yogurt. Certain yogurts, Yoplait, has carmine or cochineal. And there's actually a movement where people are talking about wanting this to be disclosed because there are people that have allergies, like to peanuts. Other stuff? They're awfully, I think I put them to sleep.
No, I think they're still learning.
Okay.
The dyeing definitely ties in with practicing associated skills.
Yes, thank you. And that's a great one. You know, they can do tie dye. I had somebody happen to be visiting who was a textile expert, and came in and showed them how to do those beautiful tie dyes. I guess in the 60s I didn't develop the skills that this person had. So they did some beautiful things. Other things or questions? It's all clear? Yes.
How expensive is the silk dyeing?
Good question. Yeah, because none of us have any money for labs. The most expensive thing is the cochineal. And if you wish, I'd be happy to send you the recipes for the dye baths. We did do a lot of empirical work on this to try to get it to where we were using what we needed to get it to dye. The other reason I used mordants, I fell into that. So let me back that up. So that little package of cochineal that you saw, and I can tell you where that comes from. It's from a company in Vancouver, BC. That's about $45, but it goes a long way. Aside from that, the silk scarves are really inexpensive. They're about a dollar or a little more. And I can, again, those that goes come from Dharma. I can give you that information. They're white. The reason I went to Mordants was I couldn't get the silk the cochineal to take to the silk. I admit that I hadn't done an important thing, which was wash out the sizing, but I don't think it would have held as well. So if you use a mordant and it actually changes the fiber, as I understand it from textile experts, then when you come in with the cochineal, it binds very strongly to the dye and it becomes color fast. If any of you are people that seamstresses, former seamstresses know this, what color fast means. It doesn't bleed when you throw it in the wash. And you also use something called Synthrapol that you wash the scarf with before and then after you're all done. So we're done? Speaking of done, thanks. And thanks, Martha.